Okay, it's my pleasure to be teaching this weekend, and we're going to have a good time together as we are kind of in the midpoint of this series on grieving, suffering, death. So encouraging. And here's the thing, the good news is the emails that I'm getting are very encouraging and asking great questions. And so if you're new, we don't always study death. We have brighter topics sometimes, but this has been helpful for where we are as a body. So I hope you're able to connect with it. Before we jump in, I want to just remind the men of something happening that starts this next coming week on some campuses and the following week on the rest of our campuses. The Quest for Purity is part of our men's roundtable curriculum. We'll run six or seven weeks, I think, and incorporated some new topics, some new ideas from the last time we did it, and so we're excited about it. Jump online and just kind of see if you go, well, I want to go with my campus, that's great, but you don't have to. If you live in Powdersville, you're like, I work in Greenville, and so it'll be easier just to do it, that's fine too. Can't do it in the morning. We have some night, some of the campuses are nighttime, and then we have different days too. So you're welcome to jump in at another campus, but let us know when and where you're coming. The point is that years ago, I jumped on a plane early one morning, went to Connecticut, was invited to come sit in and listen to a conference for sexual addiction. And so I spent 3 days at this hotel at this conference, and I'm an observer to what's going on in the moment. And after about 18 hours, my mind just started getting clear as I was sitting there, and I realized that I had had in my mind different categories of people, that I was going to go to this conference for healing for people that were in this category, and then there's other people in this category, and I was in this category. And after a day and a half of being there, I realized there were not these categories for men on this issue. There was just a continuum. And that I was just at a different place on that spectrum, that continuum, those men. They were not categorically different than I was. And that was a big insight. I came back, talked to our elders. I said, let's write some curriculum. We spent about 6 months working on it. It's been very helpful for our men. And so we have men come from other churches too. And so some guys are like, you know, your wife's like, hey, are you going to go to that? You're like, well, no, those other guys. Don't do that. Right? Don't go, those other guys. You got to kind of own this, right? It's really, really helpful for us, because if you sent a handful of women off in the afternoon to go shopping or whatever they want to go do, eat lunch, hang out, whatever, the topic of sexuality, it might come up. It might. If 4 or 5 men go play golf for an afternoon, it most assuredly will come up. Right? And so when a man comes to church, he realizes what I think and what I feel and what I want to talk about, what I'm concerned about, what's weighing me down. These people don't talk about that. The church environment, this is not appropriate to talk about here. And what I'm saying is that's been a unique shaping in the last 100 or 200 years that should not be. And so this is an environment where men can come together and learn some language, gain some tools. So I hope you'll be there. So sign up, let us know you're coming. There's a card, looks like this, in the Connect card. If you don't have one, grab one on the way out. There are extras at all of our campuses that you can grab and take and give out at work, friends, whatever. All right, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. We got a few minutes together. We take down one more issue to help us get closer to the great hope that we want to talk about. This idea of grief is a lost emotion, not lost personally, but the idea of what to do with it, how to manage it, what does it mean, where does it come from, and what it is has been lost in our culture as we've tried to distance ourselves from it. But grief is a valid emotion that we face in the loss of death, and mourning is that outward expression of that inward grief. It is dramatically, dramatically spiritual, and incredibly, even critically important that this become part of our walk with God and our discipleship. So the idea of grief, it is spiritual and it is critically important. And so, and I want to make that case this weekend. I want to make that case. I want to show it to you in the scriptures. Years ago, we had a guy on staff. He came as an intern, worked with us for a couple years before he went to help plant a church in Memphis. It was in the middle of us having children. They were younger than we were, seven, 8 years younger than we were. But we had gotten pregnant. Then they got pregnant shortly after. And we went 10 weeks or so, had a miscarriage. And so, but our pregnancies were just about lined up, and ours ended, and so theirs kept going, and it was exciting for them, but and I did notice this when I was around him, we worked together pretty closely, that I did feel from time to time, oh, their pregnancy kept, they still have one, we don't, you know, which then I felt terrible because we already had kids, they didn't even have kids yet, so this is their first child. So we get towards the end of the pregnancy, get a phone call one night at home from the hospital, and Jason says, Matt, we've lost this baby. And we're almost full term, and so we're gonna have to deliver or something. I don't know anything. And so I took off to the hospital. So we spent a couple days there, just kind of working through the trauma of carrying a child almost full term, and then having to birth that child, and doctors and nurses coming to me saying, you need to tell them this. And I was like, okay. And then we birth a baby that has died, and then we have a funeral, and it was devastatingly difficult. It drew our little church together. It was rough on all of us. I mean, I hate to complain. It was rough on me. I had small children, and so as I'm doing this funeral, I am overwhelmed with my own grief and projecting into it. It's a really, really challenging time. But afterwards, Jason began to research and study of what to do with his grief. He'd never had grief like this. So he was reading some books, and one day we were talking, and he said, I'm reading this book by this guy and who lost a son, and he said, you know, I'm never getting over this. He said, the child was too valuable to just get over them. I'm not going to forget, not going to get over. This is somebody that God created. They're way too valuable, way too important just to say, oh, I'm over that. He goes, and that's honestly a relief because I keep thinking, how am I going to get over this? How are we going to let this go? And so that idea that it has become spiritual to get over something and to let it go, and that's not, and so, you know, you've moved on. That kind of grieving is not biblical grieving, and it's not healthy grieving for us. So we want to talk about this and restore it to a proper place. Hopefully we get the conversation started. 1 Corinthians 15, page 693 in the Brown Bible. And if you need a Bible, that's yours. You can have it. It's what I carry in, so it's good. Verse 54. This is a great passage that we'll come back to on how things all come together at the end. But this is just a little three snapshots from different passages. Three little snapshots. Verse 54. Then, when our dying bodies have been transformed into bodies that will never die, the scriptures will be fulfilled. And here's what will be fulfilled. A quote from the Old Testament. Death is swallowed up in victory. 55. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? Most people, even if you're not a Christian, hadn't spent much time around church. You may not have known where those ideas, those words came from. But this is where they come from. Here's what's really important. 54, the very first two words, then, talking about sometime in the future. He goes, not now, then, in the future, when our dying bodies are transformed. So he's not talking about this moment, he's talking about another moment in the future that's different than this one. It's off in the future, it's when our bodies have been transformed. Then we'll be in a different place, and we'll be asking questions. What kind of questions? Mocking kinds of questions. Oh, death, I don't know, I can't see you. Where are you? Where's your sting? Where are you now? It's the team that you went to play that was so much taller than you were, so much bigger, so much stronger. And when you walked in, you were so intimidated. And then you found out you got into the game. They really did not have all of that together. And you beat them. And then at the end, you walk out and you're thinking to myself, oh, team, where's your sting? How powerful are you not? He says, there'll be a time in 54, then when our bodies have been transformed, when we're on the other side of death, the scriptures will be fulfilled. They're not fulfilled yet. They will be fulfilled. He said, and you will be mocking. Death will be swallowed up in victory. He says, oh, death, where's your victory? Oh, death, where's your... These are mocking kinds of questions. The one that seems so talented and so powerful has now been dismantled, and now he's being mocked because he's not so powerful now. Intimidated. Now gloating in a sense. So there is this, you're in a different place, there'll be glory and no groaning. Right now we're in the groaning. 56. For sin, he gives the explanation, is the sting that results in death, and the law gives it its power. But thank God, he gives us victory over sin and death through our Lord Jesus Christ. And so if you go back and put these two verses together and you say, now, not in the future, O death, where's your sting? If you say now, O death, where's your sting? Where's your sting? Right here. When you go to the funeral, O death, where's your sting? Death says, you're looking at it. That's why you're all crying. This person that you love so much in this casket, here's this thing right here. This is it. This is the moment of, now, he doesn't use a death nail kind of word. He uses the word sting. When you're at the funeral, when you are grieving, when someone is dying, when death is on us, that is the victory of death. It is a limited victory. It is a sting. There'll be a time in the future when we'll recount. We'll go, oh, death, where's your sting? And it won't have one. But right now, it does have one. So when you're at the funeral and you go, where's the sting? Oh, here it is. We're actually in it. We're actually experiencing it right now. There'll be a time in the future when we won't. So this sting is real. The grief is real. The death is real. The separation is real. The emotion is real. It is rooted in real loss. John 11, turn there. Page 646. We'll look at a snippet from Jesus' life. The point we are gathering is that there's real loss. There's a real sting. There'll come a time in the future when that sting won't be here. But the fact that the sting does not exist in the future does not mean that the sting does not exist right now. It does exist right now. This place of glory and groaning still has that. Verse 32. John 11, 32, page 646. When Mary arrived, and I know I'm jumping into the story. You go back and you can read it and get the whole thing. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet. She said, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. Now, is she frustrated? Exasperated? Some version of all that? Sure. When Jesus saw her weeping, he saw the other people wailing with her. Deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. One scholar says Jesus feels the weight of sin. He feels the pain of death. He feels the tumbling of death. And so he sees this woman who's sad because of her brother. He sees all of her friends wailing and crying and so upset because this man has been lost to them. And he goes, Jesus says in his mind, he's feeling that this was unnecessary. All of this has come about and it's difficult and it's painful. And he gets angry over it. I don't know. We don't know for sure, but that seems like a good explanation to me. He's smarter than I am. I'll go with him. 34. Where have you put him? He asked. They told him, Lord, come and see. And so Jesus goes to see, and what happens? And he weeps. Shortest verse, right? Jesus wept because he went and saw. This is a real experience. This is really happening. 36. The people who were standing nearby said, see how much he loved him? So there's some people who watch this event, and notice, Jesus always has two kinds of people around him. Those who are thinking about believing and leaning in, and those who are thinking about not believing and leaning away. So Jesus cries, they see that, they say, some people are around, they're like, see how much he loved him, 37. But some other ones said, this man healed a blind dude and couldn't even keep Lazarus from dying. Now how they've made those two things the same is real interesting, but that's their conclusion. He couldn't even heal, he heals this guy over here, but then this guy he actually cares about can't do anything for him. 38, Jesus was still angry, so he just wiped them all out with one look. Sorry, that's my interpretation. 38. Jesus says, not mad, it's Jesus. Go back. He was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, and a cave with a stone was rolled across its entrance. So Jesus weeps. Why? Because he's a man. This is a real experience for him. He's mourning. He feels it inside. And you see the mourning come forth in a visible way. We see the anger. He's troubled. We see him crying. So this is a real experience for him. This is really happening. This is not an illusion. So this means that Jesus is not a Buddhist. Okay, now I'm not picking on Buddhists because I'm picking on them. It's the one religion that I admire the most. Okay, it's the thing that they have some error, but there's a few ideas within Buddhism that are really attractive to me that I think are interesting to think about. One of those is that the world is defined by suffering, that all of life is suffering. Which seems pretty true. A biblical narrative would tell you that yes, suffering is pervasive. There's another truth that undergirds that of hope and glory that was found in the garden that's been corrupted. But yes, what you see now is all corruption and suffering. Another principle would say, and the way that you prevent or bring an end to suffering is you detach. Is that good thinking? That actually is pretty good thinking. Does that match up with some of what Jesus says? It does with some of it because Jesus says, don't get over-attached to money. He'll say, don't get over-attached to this. Don't get over-attached to that. So he'll say, but this is where it differs. is that they would say, detach from everything and that will eliminate suffering. Is that a good theory? It is a good theory, but it's just not truth. It's not right. Jesus is completely attached. So attached that he is mourning. So Jesus says, yes, there is corruption in the world. And there are certain things that you do detach from because they're idolatrous. You don't need to attach to them. But this man, this person is worth attaching yourself to. And he is grieving and he is crying. He's supposed to attach. You're supposed to connect because this man had value and his sisters have value and all these people have value and all their suffering is real. And we're supposed to engage each other and attach to each other, even though there is the imminent truth about loss that is coming our way. Here's why I think this is important to us. Because there are some people that are like, I can't believe he said the word Buddhist from the pulpit. I can't believe. But here's the thing. That's the way a Christian church functions a lot of time. The Christian church puts pressure on people to not mourn, to detach like Buddhist. And here's what I'm saying. That's not right. That's not true. That's not what the scriptures teach. You are not a believer in God because you don't mourn. You are not someone who truly trusts God because you don't grieve. Well, if people see me grieving, they'll think I don't trust in a future eternity. They think I don't believe in God. So, or if I grieve or if I mourn or if I suffer at this loss, then maybe that means inside that I don't really believe. Maybe that is a telltale sign that I don't truly believe in God. If I truly believed in God, I wouldn't be grieving, wouldn't be suffering. Let me say, that is not true. It's not a biblical idea. If it is, then Jesus is as lost as you are. And I'm good with that. I'd like to be as lost as he is. He is grieving. The teaching that we see is that grieving is real. We see Jesus grieving. It is not a lack of belief when someone grieves. It is not a lack of spiritual depth when they grieve, when they mourn, when they suffer. The scripture defines us as people who have souls created in the image of God that were meant to connect and value other people and attach to them. And we are directed by the scriptures to engage them and love them and to be attached. So when there is loss, it is painful. And even Jesus experienced it. 1 Thessalonians 4, page 715. Turn there, one more, last one. Verse 13, and now, dear brothers and sisters, we want you to know what will happen to the believers who have died, so you will not grieve like people who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and was raised to life again, we also believe that when Jesus returns, he will bring back with him the believers who have died. Now, there's a handful of things here that we need to affirm that are true. So we know that where are believers who have died? They're with Jesus. Are they in heaven? Not exactly. There's an intermediate state before heaven we talked about in the series Forever. We developed that fully there. You can go research that. Other resources are resources. But the idea is when someone dies, where are they? They're with Jesus. Wherever he is, whatever he is doing, that's where they are. He says when he comes back, he brings them with him. So here's a few truths to affirm. The first one is this, is that in those two verses, few things to affirm is that Jesus died, which means he's a human. Fully God, fully man, this is a human who dies. Second idea is that he's raised from the dead, which means that God approved of his work. If he was corrupt, God would have left him in the ground. But God saw him as sterling. God saw him as righteous and true, who died as an innocent man to pay for other people's sins, so God raised him from the dead. Third idea is that he will return. Return is another way of saying bring judgment. So he brings people back with him for judgment. Fourth idea, he's bringing believers with him. What's important here to know is for everybody that you have ever met, there are two parts to them. There's the body and the soul. Those two things can be separated, which is what happens at death. We're responsible to put that body in the ground in some form or some fashion. Jesus is responsible to take that soul to heaven. So we can go to the gravesite now and look at the body here in the ground. But the soul is gone. And that is one of the things that you notice that's most striking. When you walk up to that casket, is that for the person that you knew so well, when you stand over that casket and you look at them, you're like, well, this is not them. I mean, that is clear to me in this moment that this is not that person. This is the vehicle or the vessel that they traveled in. And so the soul and the body can be divided and do get divided at death. And then Jesus brings those souls back with him. And then at least one more truth needs to be affirmed in those two verses. Is that there is a double negative in the middle of that verse. It says, we do not want to grieve as those who have no hope. A double negative. That we do not grieve as those who have no hope. In other words, we do grieve as those who do have hope. So grieving and hope are not opposites. You get that? Grieving and hope are not opposites. It is the groaning and the glory are embodied in one person. Both things together in a believer. They have glory, they have groaning, they have hope, they have grief. Both of those things are deeply embedded in who they are. The Bible teaches that the grieving is part of the experience. We saw Jesus grieve. It validates that idea. That when we suffer loss, true loss, there'll be grieving. Now, not no loss, like true loss. Like, so if God decided to rapture all the coconut off the earth, no grieving with me. I'm good. That's not a real loss to me. I don't care. Right? It's not a loss to me. So there's no grieving. This is real loss, real grieving of things that matter. People have value. We attach to them. Which it makes it sad when we attach to things that really don't have value, which is what Jesus is warning of. The modern world, Christian world that we're living in, has worked diligently to separate us from the reality of death so that we won't grieve because it's a miserable experience. And so historically, death and burial and the grieving process all happened in the home. So the body stayed at the home. It didn't go anywhere. You didn't take it off anywhere to be worked on or dealt with. It stayed in the home. Family went to sleep at night. Someone came over and sat in the parlor with the body all night. And it was the person who sat with the body. And then the next day, we all go, the whole community, the family, we go, we bury this body together. We dig together. We pray together. We worship together. We sing together. We put the body in the ground together, and we cover that body with dirt together. And this is part of the grieving process, the beginning of the grieving process that we did. Those ideas were closely together. Now they've been pulled apart, which has complicated some things for us. And so it's led us to believe that grieving is not spiritual, that it's not important, that it's something to be avoided, that it's something to be ignored, and that we shouldn't have many tears. So what I want to do is, one of my neighbors on my street, name is Jane Souls, lost her husband, Tim, within the last year and a half or so. And so I just thought, as we've watched her work through some of the grieving process, there's only been a few people that I thought could articulate some of these ideas as well as she could. So we've asked her to share part of her story. So I want you to hear Jane's words about this idea.
Extremely talented, love to laugh, just a great sense of humor, loved his girls. Throughout his illness, Monica was with him at Duke much of the time, and it was just shortly after her wedding that he got sick. So that was a special time for them, you know, to be together, I'm sure both of them knowing that there wasn't a whole lot of time left. Hannah was able to be there for a week and was really the worst week of the time at Duke, and she handled it like a trooper and just a great dad. Loved his girls and prayed for them faithfully. First day, basically laying on the living room floor and next to our dog Roxy, just sobbing and just needing to let that get out. I mean, for a long time, I thought it just seemed natural that Tim should walk in, you know, and he doesn't. I think after you're just kind of in shock after it all happens. And you've been sleep deprived, you're in denial, shock, and yet you have to stay busy because there's so much to do. You feel like you're a gerbil on a wheel, and as long as you keep running, you're okay, but you're worried about when you stop. I think knowing that through what Christ did on the cross for us, he's overcome death, to say that it's not hard. Is a lie. And I think sometimes maybe Christians are want too quick to quote Bible verses and want to help people move on, you know, and get back to life. Tim was worth a great sorrow, and he was an incredible man and incredible dad and incredible husband and co-worker and friend, and so to not have tears, to not acknowledge that pain, would really be an injustice to him. And yet, thankfully, we do have the hope that Christ has overcome death.
Tim was a machine in the yard. Everything he did in life. But he would come up into my yard. He'd be like, "Matt, we need to get up there and get that garden going. And I'll bring my tiller over." I was like, "No, Tim, you work way too hard, bro. That's what you're doing is not what I'm doing." He goes, "What am I doing?" I was like, "I drive by and see what you're doing. What you're doing is real work. What I do is fake work. I just do a little bit of gardening. I plant like one thing. What I do is easy." And it just, and then to be a part of watching his decline is just difficult, you know. It's just difficult. And Jane is so gracious to be able to speak about it, and her words are so meaningful when she says, "He is worth a great sorrow. This is a great man, and he's worth a great sorrow." And the sorrow around that, the grieving around that, does not mean that this is not spiritual. It means this is deeply spiritual. Doesn't mean that she doesn't believe. It means that she does believe. It means she believes that this man she was married to was created in the image of God and was purchased back after his rebellion, was purchased back and redeemed. And so he's twice valuable. And so he's very valuable. And Jane has been great. And she emailed me a couple weeks ago and said, "Matt, after my husband died, you did a series on sex. And now you're doing a series on death. Thank you so much." I was like, "Jane, you're welcome. Anything I can do to help in the process," right? Let me just walk you through a couple ideas. We have a graph. This will help with give some language to some ideas. Death or loss can produce a couple things. It can produce denial or despair. Now, denial in the world's way of thinking could be my wife is now an angel. We cremated and returned her to the river. She's part of the mountain, something, some kind of that. But that's not so much us. As Christian circles, denial becomes an over-realized sense of she's with God and there's no pain. I don't feel anything. She told me to be with the Lord and everything's great and so great that she's a believer. And this kind of shallow view of, and this feeling of guilt if we whine about it. So this denial of the true pain in the name of being a good Christian, in the name of trying to bear up under it and show you how mature and spiritually powerful I am, that I'm not upset that this someone I care about just died and I've lost them. That doesn't bother me because I'm so spiritual. That's a form of spiritual denial, Christian denial. Then despair, on the other end of the extreme, is when you have no hope. Is when the thing that you had is now gone and you're never getting it back. That's what despair is. Whether you're a Christian or not a Christian. That feeling of that this is what I had and now it is gone and it can never come back. And the best, I had the best version of it that you could possibly have. So when a believer loses a spouse, then what have they lost? They've lost the intimacy of marriage. And despair in that application is, I had intimacy, it is now gone and I'll never get it back. It's just gone forever. That there's no hope for a future version of intimacy that is far better than what I had. So here are the counterparts. Next slide. The counterpart for that raw version of denial is genuine hope. Is that you can have a hope that says, yes, I have lost something, but I have a hope that goes beyond the loss, which informs the loss, which moves despair into the category of grief. So grief without hope is despair. Grief is made up of hope informing this kind of loss. So that the spouse has been lost and the intimacy is gone, the true believer knows that my marriage was never meant to be the fullest version of intimacy that God had. God has a greater form, a better fulfillment of intimacy somewhere in the future that will come back to me. So yes, there is legitimate loss, but there is hope rather than just raw despair, true grief, which is despair informed by hope, that there is a future intimacy waiting for me that'll be even greater than my marriage. My marriage was supposed to tip me off to the idea that God has great intimacy for me in the future. But it was not meant to be the fulfillment of it. But when you get to a place, believer or unbeliever, when what you have lost, you have truly lost it. And there is nothing on the other side of that loss. That loss, that friendship, that companionship, that intimacy, that life, that energy will never come back to you. That's when we find ourselves in a place of despair. Hope. Hope is not equal happy. Hope can be happy. Hope does not equal happy. In fact, and I called Bill right before he left the country. I was like, hey, don't go in here. He's like, hey, I'm going to Israel with 40 people. I was like, well, don't go yet. Don't get on the plane. I need to talk to you for just a second. I said, let's talk about hope for a minute before you get out of touch. And so we talked about hope for just a minute. And that what we arrived at is that hope actually has a nagging, longing, even bitter side to it. Romans 5 and Romans 8. Is that hope has a sense to it that is longing. That everything is not as it should be right now, but I am hoping, having confidence in, trusting in a moment when all of that gets resolved. So even hope is not always this ecstatic form of happiness. It has a longing to it about the future that goes beyond my loss, that moves despair into the category of grief. It is tempered. The hope tempers gives you a vision beyond the despair that says, okay, I'm going to grieve this. It informs it. In the same way, for those who hunt, I didn't have any other illustration, this idea. The one who hunts sits in the dark, in the cold, and in the rain, knowing that in 17 minutes, that sun is going to come up. His confidence, his trust, his faith is in that sun is coming up and is going to change all of this. You go, well, I'm going to sit in the dark forever. That would be despair. To sit in the dark knowing that the light is coming is a dramatically different experience. And here's what some of us are thinking as Christians. Going, okay, so what do I have to do to, when I experience loss and death, I'm going to experience hope and legitimate grief. Let me just say, do not try to formalize that and over-spiritualize it. Don't do that, because that's not going to happen. Say, well, I don't want to experience despair. You are going to. It's part of the deal. And when you start walking on the line of despair, then you get to start making some choices about how you will move toward. That begins your spiritual journey as you begin to deepen yourself and move towards hope, and despair turns into legitimate grief. And we will walk back and forth, and we will fall in and out of despair many times in our life. There will be moments of despair. But that is part of the journey of moving towards him. And Peter says in 1 Peter, he goes, I have entrusted some things to him against, old language, against that day or until that day. That all these things in my life are bottled up against the day when Jesus comes back and makes it all right and restores everything and fixes it. My hope, my confidence is in him till he comes back and fixes it. Let me give you some practical things to think about, just a handful. Just a few practical things to think about that I think would help us, because there are some things for us individually as we think about grieving and hope, grief, despair, all of that. But there's things for us corporately. It was a year ago, I took a marker with our leadership team. I said, let me show you something. I said, let's just take, at that time, 2,000 adults in our church. Adults right now. Then give them 4,000 parents. Some have already died. There's some divorce. There's some remarriage. Some have more than two parents. And so let's just go. So that's 6,000 people. Here's the thing. The generation underneath me, my children, will in some sense watch 6,000 people die if we don't grow by anybody else. This was a year ago. I mean, hadn't really thought about that. The whole goal was to plant a church. Gather some people together. Study, pray, worship. Didn't think about that it might actually take root and we'd all grow old together, produce families, and then the younger crowd would have to bury us. And there would be lots and lots of grieving. There'd be lots of burial. There'd be lots of work to do spiritually and all that. So this is important for us. Let me give you a handful of things to think about. We need to engage in a lifestyle of grieving. Is that you need to have a lifestyle of grieving where you learn how to grieve all the time, particularly around the small things. If you can't grieve the small things, how are we going to grieve the big things? So if we have, especially with our young parents, a culture of control that I think is untenable and unsustainable. So if you're thinking that your child's going to grow up and never run and fall and bust their mouth open and lose a tooth and then have this big scar on their mouth, if that is unthinkable for you, let me just say it's going to be a tough world for you to live in. And I'm sorry that they're selling you that at Babies R Us. That you can have a bubble child who's never going to get hurt, nothing bad's ever going to happen. But we're creating this culture of control that's getting a little bit interesting, and we're going to have to learn how to grieve small things. If I can't grieve losing a little bit of money, how am I going to grieve losing a spouse? And we're not meant to grieve alone. There's a culture of grief that we need to create and a lifestyle of grieving, and other people have to be a part of that, and we have to invite them in, which means they're going to see some of the most vulnerable, difficult sides to us. Another big idea. Grieving takes time. Some writers are saying 2 years. Like, I don't know. I'm not that. I'm not in charge of that. I don't know anything about that. I didn't study that or research that. I'm just telling you. That's what some people say. I mean, you know the first year's shot. Because what about Christmas without this person? That wrecks us. That does something to Christmas. And then Thanksgiving, they always made that. Now they're not here to do it. And then 4th of July, he always cooked this big thing and then blew up stuff. And then, no, he's not here to do that. I mean, there's just thing after thing. There's this going to the national championship game, and we always did that together. And now we don't ever do that together. And in the summers, we'd always go here. And then we had this hiking thing. I mean, that first cycle of a year where you experience all of that, it just takes time. Years ago, I was talking to meeting Charlie Boyd for lunch as a pastor at Southside Fellowship, Baptist Greenville Fellowship, whatever the name of it is now. I give him a hard time, right? So we're having lunch, and there had been a big vote with their church, some decision, probably changing their name. And so, good Lord, I'm going to be in trouble. So they're taking this big vote, and I was like, well, how'd it go? And he's like, this is great. He goes, and then he said, I got off the stage, and I went in the back, and I grabbed the phone. He goes, I literally grabbed the phone to call my dad. He goes, my dad's been dead 9 months. He goes, I want to tell my dad about it. He's gone. He goes, I can't get it out of my head. And how awesome is that, to having someone leading this very powerful church in our area say, I can't get this out of my head. Right? Because it's grieving. It's not supposed to get out of your head. It's supposed to be in your head. It's going to take some time. Genesis 49 and 50, the death of Jacob. He blesses all his sons, and then he dies, and then they mourn it in Egypt, and then they have permission to go back home. And then it says, as it tells you the narrative, this takes weeks and weeks and weeks to do all this. And it says the Canaanites are standing there watching these Egyptians mourn for weeks and weeks and weeks this man that's not even Egyptian in a land that's not even Egypt. It is fascinating. The time and energy they put into grieving is important to do. We're going to post some articles. They probably already have posted on our blog site. One about some of the practical steps and ideas around grieving. The other one that deals with a response to the normal cycles of denial and anger and bargaining and some of that. Because that is true for a lot of us. But there's also a lot of us that don't work through those cycles in that exact way. So we got an article posted that may help you think through some of that. But to think that it is not spiritual, or that it is spiritual to not grieve, that is wrong. That is not true. We should not just be over it. Third idea. I've gotten a handful of emails from two or three of our different campuses saying, please address this. The idea of what do we do in our grieving when a family member or a friend, someone that has died, is not a Christian? And then how do you mourn and grieve in that context? This is a difficult one. Let me just give you a few things to think about. The first one is this. I would not jump to conclusions that you know. Jesus dedicates a whole section in the Gospels where he says, all these people that know they're going to heaven, they come to me like, Lord, Lord, look what we did for you. And he's like, depart from me, for I never knew you. And they're shocked. So we've overestimated these people's ability to get in. And so Jesus says, you shouldn't evaluate that way. You don't really know. So we probably shouldn't evaluate on the other side and be like, oh, they're not getting in. I'm so sad for them. You got to know what you know and learn how to trust God with what you do not know. So the overjudging and the overestimating as if I know something that I may not know. So for one man that I had spent years talking about spiritual things with, and he was a scientist and really smart, and so we would argue about Darwin and evolution and all that. So then he's in an intensive care unit and he's dying. And they said, I walked in just to pray with him, and I said, well, he's out. And they said, no, he can hear you. He can probably hear you. He said, he's going to die soon, but he can hear you. So I sat down and I just said, Charlie, I said, here's the thing. I don't know what this looks like to you. I said, but let me tell you what I see as I sit here. I said, you're not going to live much longer. I said, and I want to apologize for us arguing about Darwin and the origin of the species and how old the earth is all the time. That was a waste of time. I said, let me make something else real clear to you. And I walked into the gospel as clear as I could. So then I leave the hospital. I get 15 minutes down the road, not even 12 minutes down the road. And I get a call and they say, he just died. Okay, so did he not hear and then his body wore out? Did he hear and make peace with God? And I have no idea. There's no way for me to know that. This is not my job to be in charge of that. But here's what I would say. If I have room for mercy, if I have room for grace, if I have room for compassion, if I want to compel people to come, and I'm really selfish, imagine how much room for compassion and mercy and grace and how compelling God is. Do not think that you would in any sense or measure be more compassionate, more compelling, or more gracious than God is. We can rest in that idea that he is far more. If I feel grace towards someone, he feels grace towards them. So we do not know that whole story. But the fact is, there are people around us who do not know Christ, and they go into a Christless eternity separated from God. And you go, well, there's some tension there. How do I resolve that? You're not supposed to resolve that. You're supposed to have that tension wash over you and feel on the hook. It's not my job to take that off of you. The Apostle Paul says, I wish that all my Jewish brothers were cursed, or that I was cursed for them. In other words, Paul says, I wish I could go to hell so that they could all go to heaven. I would trade places with them. I would bargain with God and say, God, you take me to hell and let all of them go free. He feels the tension and the pressure. He says in Acts, my hands are free of the blood of all men. Why is his hands free of the blood of all men? Because he says, I preached in the synagogue and I preached in the homes. I preached out on the street and I preached in private. Everybody that I could meet and talk to, I have shared with, my hands are clean. The idea being, if I had not done that, my hands would not be clean. So when you go, I'd like to remove the tension and the responsibility I feel about people and their relationship with God and how they spend eternity. No, you cannot do that. There is some tension that needs to be on us for that we need to feel. Fourth idea, we need to actively engage folks who are grieving and suffering. Romans 12, 15, the second part of that, he goes, we rejoice with those who rejoice and we weep with those who weep. Because we're part of the same family, we're part of the same body. We weep with those who weep. We're one body. Just some practical things. Most people who are mourning or grieving feel that the people around them are avoiding them because they are afraid. And I would just say, don't allow yourself to become a person that is afraid because you don't know what to say or do, so you avoid people who are suffering or grieving. Don't do that. Just don't be afraid. You go, I don't know what to do. Don't be afraid. Just know that could be you. It just happens to be them. So don't avoid them. But most everyone I talk to who is grieving, particularly people who lose children, feel like they are avoided by other people who still have children because they don't know what to say or do. One guy told me, I wrote him a letter after he'd lost a child, and he said, you know, years later, he said, I don't know what you said in that letter. He goes, all I remember was reading my son's name. He goes, now I realize how much I love hearing his name. He goes, and no one wants to say his name because he's dead. And they're afraid it's going to make me upset. He goes, it might make me upset. He goes, but I love hearing his name. He goes, I saw it in print. And I thought, he lived. He was real. We didn't dream that. That happened. We didn't dream it. We didn't make it up. It really happened. He was here. He died. It's the worst thing that ever happened to us, but it did happen. And how affirming and valuable to have other people acknowledge that this happened rather than act like it didn't happen. And that was really instructive for me, and that was an accident. I didn't know. I didn't mean it that way, and it just came off as really helpful. Don't arrogate yourself. Don't become arrogant and think, well, I'm not going to engage because I don't know what to say. I can't fix it. That's not your job, not my job to fix it. Don't think that you can fix something that you can't fix. We move towards people, not because we can fix it, so we can be with them. And if there are practical things to do to serve, then do those things. If you want to cut the grass, cut the grass. You want to write a note, write a note. You want to buy something, buy something. Sometimes when you ask people, is there anything I can do for you? They're already so overwhelmed, they can't think of anything. So just do, if you think there's something that needs to be done, you just do that. If it's the wrong thing, it'll be okay. And we'll give them options. Hey, I'm going to do this for you, or I'm going to do this for you. Which one would you prefer? Well, you don't need to do anything. I'm not asking if. I'm telling you, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do this one. You get a chance to shape all that. Just tell me so we can do it. And just love them that way because it's just a difficult season. And the last one, suffering and the loss is a fresh look at the gospel for us. Because suffering for us raises great questions that we need to answer. It raises this question for Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken me? So if it raises that question for Jesus, you know it's going to raise questions for someone like me. It's going to raise questions. I mean, is God not real? Maybe I'm just deluded myself. Maybe my parents deluded themselves and all these people who go to church delude themselves and it just makes you feel better. It's your big crutch. It's delusional. God's not real. Or maybe God's not good. He's an evil God. That's why evil things happen. He's bad and that's why all these bad things happen. That's why bad things are happening to me. Or he doesn't love me. He doesn't even care. I mean, he's all powerful, but I mean, he's what he's doing. Making watches, winding them up, turning them loose. They didn't care. Not powerful. Can't solve these problems. All this is too much for him. Or he's punishing me. I had an abortion. I had an affair. I stole some money 10 years ago. And now this is what I get. This is what he's doing. Punishing me. As if he's limited and has to be real strategic in punishing people. He has to figure it out on the fly. Who knows? We walk that line of despair. But here's what I'm telling you. The line of despair is a journey to come to know him in a new way. When we start bringing hope to bear on it and we move from despair to grief. Because here's why. God is the Father who's lost a son. See, the Greek gods in the day of Jesus and Paul, they were detached and impersonal. They never suffered anything, really. And they didn't care about you and your suffering. But this God enters in, unlike the Greek gods, he enters in and it becomes very personal and he suffers. He suffers the death on the cross to pay for sins, but then the Father suffers watching his son. And so they've experienced the pain and they've experienced the loss. And so as far as the curse is found, we sing Joy to the World. As far as the curse is found, Jesus has penetrated that far into this world to take on that suffering for us. He knows the suffering and he knows the loss. And here's what I would tell you. That is a God that you can trust. You can trust him with your life. You can trust him with your death, you can trust him with your sin, and you can trust him with your grief. Because we have the glory and the groaning inside of us. Let's pray. Father, would you continue to lead us? This makes us incredibly vulnerable to have to think about the groaning and the frailty and how weak we are to address it. That we cannot extend our days. We cannot extend the days of our spouse or our children. We have a culture of control that is an illusion. It does not exist. But we are hoping in it and we are trusting in it. And then, Father, when the world comes apart on us, then we realize the thing that we should have been trusting in, we've not been trusting in you. So, Father, would you show us what it means to embrace the loss, to grieve well, and as we move into despair, to be able to find your hope that draws us back, that brings that balance to us. Pray that you would speak to us and give us tools and language to move towards you and your mercy. We ask it in your name. Amen.